Hi there, Liz here, welcoming you all to episode 2 of the festive edition of the Black Country Talking News.
Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by the sight loss charity Beacon. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. Once you've enabled the Talking Newspapers skill, all you need to do is play Talking Newspapers and ask for the Black Country Talking News. Our Talking News service is also available via the free Wireless for the Blind app. It can be found on the Beacon Centre website, www.beaconvision.org/talking-news. As a podcast via services such as Apple or Spotify, or as a free CD, simply contact Beacon Centre on 01902 880 111. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
In this edition, we have some Christmas cracker jokes full of festive fun and cheer, and a topical brain teaser for the winter season in the form of an audio-based I Spy. Our gardening experts provide some ideas for bringing nature indoors to decorate the house over the festive period, and also some tips for outdoor garden tasks in December. And from Christmas in the 50s to pined for toys from the 70s, 80s and 90s, there's plenty of nostalgia to bring us some warm feelings of Christmas past. Some interesting news to start though. After a recent article from eye healthcare company Optegra marking the dangers of sparkling drinks bottles such as champagne, Prosecco and their non-alcoholic equivalents, with thanks to Soundings contributors Fiona and Alan, we have some rather useful guidance helping you to take care opening bottles of fizz this Christmas and New Year so that you can avoid the risks of eye injuries from flying corks, including expert tips on how to open bottles safely.
Hello, this is Alan, with an article written by Fiona, warning us all to watch out for eye injuries from champagne corks this Christmas and New Year, and with some advice at the end on how to open a champagne bottle safely. Keep an eye on those champagne corks this festive season, but not too close an eye. Many of us like to mark Christmas or New Year with a glass of fizz, but be careful when opening the bottles, especially if poor eyesight means you can't make out everything that's going on. Eye injuries from uncorking bottles of sparkling wine, quote, are an often overlooked and substantial threat to ocular health, unquote, according to medical news website MedPage Today. The website references an article in a British medical journal Christmas edition by Dr. Ethan Weisberg of the University of Cambridge. Dr. Weisberg wrote, "While watching a friend uncork a champagne bottle in an unsafe manner, I got the idea to look at ocular injuries from cork launches." Weisberg and his colleagues learned that the pressure in a 750-milliliter bottle of sparkling wine is about 3 times that of a standard car tyre, with the potential to launch a cork up to 43 feet at speeds of up to 50 miles per hour. They also found that a cork can travel from the bottle to the eye in less than 0.05 seconds, making the blinking reflex ineffective. There have been some high-profile cork injuries, including the May 2022 case of cyclist Binyam Girmay, who opened a bottle of Prosecco to celebrate his victory in the Giro d'Italia. Unfortunately, the cork hit him in the eye and caused an anterior chamber hemorrhage, causing him to withdraw from the rest of the competition. And back in 2016, Australian researchers reported a case of commotio retinae, or traumatic retinopathy, due to a champagne cork hitting the eye of a 29-year-old from about 10 feet away. Finally, a 2009 review of 34 cases of eye injuries caused by bottle corks and caps from sparkling wine bottles in Italy showed various degrees of visual impairment and clinical outcomes such as perforation, trauma, and long-term complications. The American Academy of Ophthalmology's public safety campaign, called Uncork with Care, offers advice for the safe opening of bottles of sparkling wine. This is what they say. Chill sparkling wine and champagne to 45 degrees Fahrenheit or colder before opening. The cork of a warm bottle is more likely to pop unexpectedly. Don't shake the bottle. Shaking increases the speed at which the cork leaves the bottle, thereby increasing your chances of severe eye injury. Point the bottle at a 45 degree angle away from yourself and any bystanders, and hold down the cork with the palm of your hand while removing the wire hood on the bottle. Place a towel over the entire top of the bottle and grasp the cork. Twist the bottle while holding the cork at a 45 degree angle to break the seal. Counter the force of the cork using downward pressure as the cork breaks free from the bottle. Those are great safety tips. So, if you're going to indulge in a glass of fizz over Christmas or New Year, please make sure you open the bottle safely.
Did you catch any of the action over the weekend? What were your thoughts? Don't forget you can now get involved with the football roundup here on the Talking News by simply leaving a WhatsApp message or voice note, text message or voicemail on 07849 802 703. So without further ado, let's head over to this week's Fan Zone and get our prized pundit's take on what unfolded over the weekend. Starting with our Wolves superfan Fraser.
Hi guys, it's Wolves superfan Fraser here. I haven't done a podcast in a while because I haven't been to a match, but I thought I better do one because a lot has gone on lately. Things haven't been going well at the Wolves. And my hero, Mario Lemina, is no longer captain. And, thank heavens, they've sacked Gary O'Neill. I wonder who the new manager's going to be then. I wish it was Nuno, but whoever it is, I hope we get some more wins. Anyhow, here's a joke to cheer you up, a bit of a Christmassy one. Which of Santa's reindeer have bad manners? Rudolph. And I'd also just like to wish you all a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Come on, me babies!
Hi, this is Jamie the Wolves fan, speaking after Wolverhampton Wanderers 1, Ipswich Town 2. I thought the first half was pretty poor, but the second half was much better. And we come back into the game, and I thought we threw it away. And on the sacking of Gary O'Neill, I am actually quite pleased that he's been sacked. He should have been sacked weeks ago. And I just wanted to say that I think Herrera hopefully is the right appointment, but as he's a Portuguese man, we don't know.
Here, Wolves fan. The match didn't go to plan, obviously, blah, blah, blah. O'Neill should have been sacked weeks ago. This new manager, obviously, we need a miracle. So hopefully I'll get things right. Touch wood. Okay.
Time now for some memories from a childhood Christmas, and Soundings contributor Colin recalls a family visit to his grandparents on Boxing Day 1950, which included a visit from Father Christmas and an extra special treat.
Hello, this is Colin. I'm going to tell you about one particular childhood Christmas. When I was a small child, Boxing Day was traditionally spent together with our relatives, at my grandparents' large house in North London. Christmas 1950 was no different. At that time, most of my relatives lived in the same area, and very few had cars. I remember we walked to my grandparents, My mum and dad loaded down with bags of food. Everyone chipped in. There was still rationing, remember? As well as presents for the family. Everyone bought for the children in the family, and there were lots of us. The Boxing Day meal was undertaken with the precision of a military campaign. The children dined at a large trestle table, which had been erected in the conservatory, while the grown-ups had their meal in another room, seated around my grandfather's full-size snooker table, which fortunately had a wooden cover. I'm really not sure how they managed to feed all of us at the same time, but they did. Once the meal was finished, the younger members of the family were more than ready for the highlight of the evening. This was a visit of Father Christmas to distribute the small mountain of presents at the foot of the Christmas tree, which stood in the Holy of Holies, the front room. Although we'd all had our main presents at home the day before, there was the added excitement of more gifts to come from the grandparents, uncles, and aunts. A distant uncle, dressed in a red suit with a false beard, had been sent outside to tap on the window to announce the arrival of Father Christmas. And no trigger warnings for our mental health in those days. Think about it. A strange man with a false beard and a red nose peers unannounced through the window at a group of children. But remember, this was 1950. We still had rationing and trigger warnings related specifically to our Roy Rogers cap pistols, whereas for our mental health, we had to make do with either "I'm feeling a bit fed up today" or "I'm feeling all right," etc. Anyway, one of us was delegated to let in Uncle Jim, or whoever's turn it was that year, to play the man in the red suit. His entrance was greeted with cheers and wild applause, and he soon set to work handing out the presents. As soon as his task had been completed, a greatly relieved Father Christmas, or Uncle Jim, left, leaving a trail of destruction consisting of torn wrapping paper in his wake. He then returned to the house 5 minutes later, ready for a well-earned Christmas drink. Later, in another part of the house, while the grown-ups were making short work of whatever alcoholic beverages were on offer, I remember there always seemed to be a barrel of beer in evidence. And my grandfather would settle us all down in orderly rows before switching on the magic box in the corner of the room. Yes, a television set. My grandparents were the first in our huge family to own a television. It probably cost them a small fortune. The set was enormous, about the size of a large refrigerator. Oh, they had one of those too. Housed in a highly polished wooden cabinet, the screen measured a massive 9 inches. However, being the engineer that he was, my grandfather had thoughtfully added a magnifier, which was strapped around the screen like some large surgical appliance. In those days, the BBC only broadcast for a few hours a day. Programs started around 5 o'clock and finished before 11 o'clock and were transmitted live from Alexandra Palace, not far from where we lived. We sat with the curtains tightly closed and the lights switched off, patiently waiting for the set to warm up. This usually took a few minutes. The screen then flickered into life in glorious black and white. We were then treated to the pantomime Cinderella. I've since checked and discovered that it starred Jack Hulbert and Sally Ann Howes. We stared in wonder at the images which were displayed on what was, to us, a truly magic box. It wasn't until much later, in the 1950s, that we had our own television set at home. By that time, sets were smaller, but still only had the one channel and limited viewing time. Today, we can watch countless programs of, well, it has to be said, varying quality on hundreds of channels, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Is this a good thing? You tell me. All I know is that back in the 1950s, we had no idea of what was to come, and that once released from the bottle, like a pantomime genie, there would be no going back. Have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Up next, we have a topical brain teaser for the winter season in the form of an audio-based iSpy, informally called ESPY Clean Sweep. Find out if you can count all the winter sports mentioned in this descriptive conversation at a ski resort. The answers are fully detailed and included later in this edition. Best of luck.
Clean Sweep Brain Teaser at the Ski Resort. Welcome to Lindsay's ESPY activity for yourself or with others. Listen carefully to this one-sided imaginary telephone conversation and find out how many winter sport names you can recognise along the way. The correct number will be announced at the end. Yes, let me be the first to welcome you to Nordic Combined Resort. Sorry you had a difficult journey. Still, be nice to catch up on your plans this week, even if I am stuck cleaning the millionaire chalet for owner Bob Sled and his guests. Mind you, some of the perks is looking through the visitor book. No perks, not peaks, as in ice climbing, Wilma. According to the first page, three real high flyers were here. Places Rad got mega snowfall second day and hit the powder. Great for snowboarding in the valley. Espresso machine could use more hot chocolate options. Cheers, Tobe, Og, and Ing. From Wales, I think. Hard to tell from their handwriting. Don't suppose they get much practice, what with using electronic devices these days. Anyway, how is my nephew finding the activities in the area? Really? Go figure, skating would be his favourite. Always thought dog sledding would be the top attraction. He's such an animal lover. Place noticed he was too young to drive the sled. Ah, seems like these next guests also liked pushing the boundaries. Brochure claimed downhill skiing was possible right from the rear door to the cable car, but did not mention the rocky terrain. Week we stayed, hardly any snow, making this route impossible. Trekked lugging skis for whole distance. Yours disappointed, Jackson Vancouver and Lily Hammer. You're right, should have gone cross-country skiing instead. Hang on a minute, best wrap my sandwich for lunch, otherwise the edges dry out and begin curling up. Talking about up, listen to this one. Excellent views from the top lounge and half-roofed balcony, a definite plus. Ideal for experiencing snow kiting. Not sure, Wilma. Think it involves a kite, obviously, and probably a skier being powered along underneath, like beach surfing. There's more on the page. Children were delighted when set out on day trip to visit the St. Bernard dog kennels on the high altitude pass, as detailed in the information pack. However, the dogs were all indoors in such fiercely hot, centrally heated kennels, they just lay there dozing the whole time. Quite boring tour. Whilst not connected to the chalet itself, this should be highlighted that they snooze, you lose. Could do better. Luge family. Wilma, I might lose you a little too. Phone signal isn't great when going out back to the bins. It's a fair way and snakes quite wildly between buildings. The local maintenance guy, Diva, nicknamed the path Giant Slalom. The slope is very steep. Almost like the ski jumping stadium on the edge of town. That's more like it. Warm indoors again. Now then, who else wrote in the visitor's book? Enjoying the heated garage and driveway, and some unexpected friends dropped in and had to après-ski shop ingredients for a fondue. delight simply jumping in the car and gliding out the ice-free drive. Drinks on the balcony also without ice. Fishing tomorrow, what a great vacation spot. Even if no magnificent fjords like in Greenland last year. Albertville and Cortina d'Ampezzo. Maybe a brag or maybe a complaint. I'll give you that, Wilma. Bit obscure. Oh, really? You must head off now to the ice rink. There's a junior taster ice hockey session that he wants to try. Okay, well, I guess it will take about 6 minutes. Bye for now.
Did you know that feasting at midwinter is an ancient practice adapted to Christmas time and a chance to be merry? For more on this, we can hear from Soundings contributor Alice Dare, who explains how the long history of winter feasting has changed over the years.
This is Alistair Hutton with a look back at Christmas feasts over the years. We always associate Christmas with the chance to indulge ourselves, with eating and drinking often to excess. So where did this habit come from? Have people always been in the habit of gorging themselves at Christmas? Old Christmas poems and songs talk about food, and there are references in the writing of Sir Walter Scott in such tales as A Christmas Carol to the food enjoyed at Christmas. But feasting in midwinter goes back far beyond the birth of the Saviour, which is only a couple of thousand years ago. There's evidence of midwinter feasting from the Neolithic period around 6,500 years ago in Britain and much earlier elsewhere. It was probably around the midwinter solstice, which was pretty close to our modern date of Christmas. Then, our ancestors ate beef and pork, plus crab apples, hazelnuts, sloes, and blackberries. The Romans celebrated Saturnalia with feasts starting on about the 17th of December and lasting for about a week, and these practices were taken over by the early Christians, who turned them to their own benefit and pleasure. In medieval monasteries, much tastier dishes with herbs flavouring the fish and pies, which took the place of the normally bland food at Christmas time. Later, beef, pork, and venison were added, and all were savoured with wines from France. Eating, drinking, and merriment spread well beyond the monasteries, with game, which might include such oddities to our palates, as badger, blackbird, peacock, swan, and souse, pickled pig's ears and feet, as well as goose, pigeon, chicken, or hare, in addition to beef, venison, and boar. Turkeys appeared in Britain in 1523 and were soon seen as a rare delicacy. As the years wore on, the main choice at Christmas was a goose, although turkeys were becoming more plentiful. There was also turtle soup, fish, cockles, and mussels, brawn, mince pies, and plum pudding. The mince pies contained more fruit and less meat than in previous centuries, and there was also a porridge-like sauce called frumenty, made with grains, almonds, currants, and sugar, which was served with the meat. That later evolved into the Christmas pudding. In the 19th century, goose was still the main meat, plus roasted ham with stuffing, and the vegetables we know today, potatoes, sprouts, parsnips, carrots, and a cabbage. By the 20th century, turkey had overtaken goose and was served with bread sauce, and in the 1930s, brandy butter began to accompany the Christmas pudding. But Christmas feasting is not confined to Britain. Around the world, many nations have adopted their own culinary treats for Christmas. One of the most universal is the king cake, believed to have originated in the Roman Saturnalia. The cake represents the three kings who visited the newly born Christ child, and usually contains a bean or the tiny figurine of a baby. The person who finds the bean or the figurine becomes king or queen for the day. The king cake, usually shaped like a large doughnut to represent a crown, gave way in Britain to the Christmas cake. But the tradition flourishes elsewhere. In Portugal, the king cake is eaten from the beginning of December until Epiphany. Over the border in Spain, the cake is given a sweet aroma with orange blossom water and decorated with slices of candied or crystallized fruit of various colors. It can be filled with whipped cream, cream or almond paste. This tradition spread to Mexico and Central and South America and north into the United States, where it's also associated with Mardi Gras. Away to the north in Iceland, households try to outdo themselves with a fried wafer-thin delicacy decorated with intricately cut patterns and shapes called leaf bread, plus smoked lamb, a local seabird, and even reindeer. In Denmark, the king cake tradition is varied, with a whole almond hidden in a rice pudding. Whoever gets the almond gets a present. On the other side of the world, Aussies fire up their barbies to cook steaks, chicken, prawns, lobster, and crayfish in the sun. When it comes to desserts, the sweet Italian bread panettone, which is said to have originated in Milan, became the country's leading sweet after the Second World War, and its popularity has spread around the world, particularly to Latin America, where it replaced the king cake in some countries. The German fruitcake Stollen, which is reputed to have first appeared in 1545, has changed steadily over the years from a simple, tasteless creation when the use of butter was forbidden and only flour, yeast, oil, and water could be used. Now, the much sweeter loaf containing fruit and marzipan and dusted with icing sugar has become an international favorite. In Brazil, Rabanda is a popular variation on French toast, slightly stale bread, dipped in eggs and milk and fried, before being covered in sugar, cinnamon, and a spiced port syrup. And of course, in Scotland at Hogmanay, we still enjoy that traditional dense fruitcake covered in pastry, black bun. But wherever you are in the world, north, south, east, or west, the Christmas season will always be the time of year to eat, drink, and be merry.
Well, that sounds fantastic. All this talk has got me searching for a good old book. So how about we all grab a cuppa and nestle down in our comfy spots?
This is a whimsical little poem called The Escape Committee by my old friend Adam Ferguson. Read by Alastair Hutton. The head of the escape committee briefed the captives in their hut. There is nothing that can hold us once the wire netting's cut. Lucky that we found the pliers. Two more things I have to say. Every turkey for himself, and breakouts planned for Boxing Day.
Time for something fascinating now, as Soundings contributor Lindsay presents another one of her cabin conversations. An interesting foliage journey of discovery about the O Christmas Tree Carol, the humble Christmas tree and various historic traditional winter season customs surrounding decorations and evergreens.
Hello, my name is Lindsay. I started producing topical items during lockdown to keep my neighbours entertained. All the recordings are made inside my cosy cabin for that extra sense of calm. And naturally enough, I called them Cabin Conversations. I hope you enjoy them. Cabin Conversations about O Christmas Tree. It is hard to imagine the innocence and magical wonder of a non-commercial Christmas these days, when the seasonal adverts, town decorations, and shopping bargains start around September. Yet in olden days, the biggest extravagance seemed to be focused purely on the humble Christmas tree. The famous carol, O Christmas Tree, was never intended as a Christmas song at all. Simply an updated folk song, O Tannenbaum, or rather translated as O Fir Tree, to give it the correct title, was a song composed and extended by two verses by the organist and teacher Ernest Anschütz in 1824, Leipzig, Germany. Britain did not indulge in these European winter season traditions of honouring and decorating individual trees until Queen Victoria's reign in mid-19th century, when fashion and availability was widespread. Despite the original single verse of the carol losing its meaning of the tree's evergreen quality as a symbol of constance and faithfulness, at least both the song and the fir tree have become entwined as quintessential elements of Christmas celebrations. Another astounding fact, the fir tree was not specific to Christmas either. In the ancient Hebrew, Egyptian, and Chinese civilizations, any outdoor evergreen branches such as laurel would suffice. And a 15th century Portuguese monastery was possibly the first to record placing candles inside red oranges on ceremonial branches by way of lighting. Evergreens at this point were a symbol of eternal life and to bring good spiritual health. It was the pagan Europeans, particularly the Scandinavians, who took the decorating of home and barn exteriors with evergreens to a whole new level, adorning branches mainly with fruits like apples and nuts for future prosperity while sustaining the birds through winter. Even then, house decorating took place at New Year, not Christmas. Ultimately, the desire to bring inside evergreen trees necessitated finding a species that would be flexible and tolerant of sudden temperature differences for a reasonable period. Evergreen conifers of fir, pine, and spruce were ideal and strong enough to bear candles, fruit, and gifts. This was long before the O Christmas Tree Carol, yet the first lyrics refer to this very resilience of which it is prized, mentioning summer's heat and winter's snow, and still in its prime letting faithfulness bloom. Indeed, winter solstice and fertility blessings are also bestowed upon Christmas trees in several countries, even today, through song and dance, as would be traditionally associated with British maple ceremonies, something no doubt that would have been difficult around the world's largest cut Douglas fir Christmas tree in Seattle, Washington State, America, in 1950, as the tree reached 64.6 meters or 212 feet high. Artificial Christmas trees similar to their modern equivalents were commercially introduced, made of bristled toilet brushes dyed green and sold by a British-based housewares company back in 1930. And the tallest public artificial tree recorded was found in Colombo, Sri Lanka at 72.1 metres or 236 feet 6.58 inches. Internationally, natural fir trees have been presented as actual Christmas gifts from one country to another for various reasons, though mostly to commemorate peace after conflict. The well-known tradition of Norway presenting the British people with a Christmas tree in Trafalgar Square, London, and one specifically from Bergen, Norway, to Newcastle upon Tyne, both as acknowledgements of support during World War II. To the lesser-known kind act of giving a Christmas tree from the city of Manchester in 1918, along with £500 to buy cakes and chocolate for the children of Lille, northern France, after the town's devastation during the First World War. Perhaps there is something to be learned from the carol and the humble fir tree about adapting to thrive on less. Simpler decorations, foods, and quality time with family and friends could make an equally happy Christmas season. May your own traditions and beliefs be enhanced by cherishing nature.
Next up, we have another block of local news. Whether you're a 70s child or were born in the early 1990s, there will be toys that you remember pining for at Christmas. How many must-have gifts you remember from your childhood? And do you still have some of these treasures tucked away in your loft? From games consoles to outdoor fun, with thanks to the Express and Stars feature writer Mike Lockley, it's time now to make a tour of some of our favourite Christmas toys through the year.
I am the malevolent, cursing ghost of Christmas past, a festive fossil from an age when the seasonal bags of assorted nuts didn't carry health warnings. I am the curmudgeonly, cursing ghost of Christmas past, so old I recall excitingly dragging a satsuma from the heel of my Christmas stocking. Yes, I was underwhelmed and filled with false expectation because Mum insisted on wrapping the fruit. She did the same with the grapes, which must have taken an inordinate amount of time. But then she began early in November. I am the grey-haired ghost of Christmas past, made garrulous by grouse whiskey and fragrant by Fabergé's brute aftershave. I jigged giddily to Slade's festive classic first time around. I walked wide-eyed through Beattie's toy department. Therefore, the list of recent year's top Christmas gifts for children, compiled by the Toy Retailers Association, means nothing to me. It is a strange language from a sci-fi world. It is a baffling newspeak of names and numbers. Minted Dog-E interactive robot dog is expected to fly off the shelves. Squish mallows are very big. The Christmas night will be spent playing Twister Air. The packaging informing purchases, match your wrist and ankle bands to the spots on screen. I vaguely remember a distant version of Twister, a game that involved closely knit groups of people contorting their bodies. I think students used it as a stumbling precursor to intimacy. I now indulge in an OAP version of Twister that requires the same balance, dexterity, and physical exertion. I tie my shoelaces while standing. I am the scowling, wrinkled ghost of Christmas past, a mean spirit from the time when children were allowed and encouraged to sit on Santa's lap. My Santa had nicotine-stained fingers, and the store manager told him, "Big queue this morning, Dave."
In 1969, a year when there was only one TARDIS-sized computer that simply spat out premium bond numbers, I received the most high-tech, what would be described today as jaw-dropping gift available. Those who possessed Slinky, 8 feet of shiny coiled spring, were presented with a portal to a distant future world. It walked, unaided, downstairs. It was a one-trick pony, a miracle that wore thin after mere minutes, as hinted by the irritating TV jingle. What walks downstairs, alone or in pairs, and makes a slinkety sound? A spring, a marvellous thing. Those children who watched in awe as Slinky did its one and only thing would probably faint when coming face to face with a Nintendo Wii. Slinky had actually been with us since the 1940s, accidentally invented by American naval engineer Richard James while developing a new suspension system. It was therefore a mistake, which begs the question, how did something so terribly wrong turn out so right? It even won a starring role in the Toy Story films. Online encyclopedia Wikipedia states, in 1960, after his wife filed for divorce, Richard James became an evangelical missionary in Bolivia. Interestingly, Bolivia was a slinky-free zone. On Boxing Day, Dad trod on mine, and it never walked alone again. I am the bellicose ghost of Christmas past, bloated by brandy butter, bilious on snowball cocktails. And I, therefore, view with interest the historical list of toys most unwrapped on December the 25th, compiled by online retailer Music Magpie.
The children of 1971 were easily pleased. The product that left the rest lagging in the Christmas consumer rush was a space hopper, a large orange ball with antlers that children bounced on until they could bounce no more. The smiling rabbit face branded on the rubber hid evil intent, with Space Hopper, which set parents back £2.25, possibly only eclipsed by skateboards on the accidents waiting to happen scale of infant playthings. The problem was children bounced everywhere on them, bar the M6 Fastlane. On website Toys Toys Toys, one former owner recalls, "Almost the most dangerous toy kids from the pre-health and safety generation could acquire. School grounds across the country were buzzing with urban legends about kids who had maimed themselves in various horrific ways, all with the aid of the dreaded Space Hopper." Nostalgia Central states, "The Space Hopper bounced into the UK in 1969 and served absolutely no useful purpose. The TV advert promised some sort of wonder device that would see the end of cars and bicycles as a means of transport. In reality, of course, they didn't allow you to go faster, bounce higher, or run further than you could on foot. In a nutshell, that was the fundamental flaw. Parents were pestered for a more dangerous toy in 1972, the Skateboard Christmas, a landlocked surfboard that would spread cold fear on pavements for years to come. Things were to become decidedly more surreal in the decade, with Pet Rock topping Santa's list in 1975. For £1.75, a stone in custom cardboard box with ventilation holes and straw bedding was yours. My dad thought outside the box, quite literally, and gave me a brick. Inventor Gary Dahl had a light bulb moment whilst listening to drinking companions bemoan their living pets. He may now be making a lucrative life selling snow to Eskimos. Back then it was fun. Today, those who have a rock for companionship are urged to seek help. Those who speak to their stone are avoided on public transport.
I curse 1985 for giving the nation Trivial Pursuits, a torturous brain teaser that has allowed armchair boffins and family know-it-alls to bask in fleeting glory for a succession of Christmases. May they choke on their plastic cheeses. It is the game that forced this writer to leave the room in embarrassment after being asked, "What does a peacock mate with?" Simpler times when you received an orange and were grateful. "Is it his beak?" I answered. "Peahen!" shrieked the family know-it-all. From there, Christmas gifts reflected the power of the silver and small screen. The number one in 1988 was Ghostbusters Proton Pack, costing $19.99. A gift that enabled owners to imprison their own poltergeist. In 89, it was the Batmobile. A year later, Ninja Mutant Ninja Turtle figures were flying off the shelves, followed by Power Rangers in 1994. But the days were numbered for such simple childish things, and 1991, the computer age truly arrived on our doorsteps. Handheld Nintendo Game Boy, back then a pricey $69.99, was the must-have, selling during its lifespan near 119 million units worldwide. Soon shouts of, "You've been on that computer all day," would ring from every home. PlayStation, £287.95, topped 95. Nintendo 64, £150, ruled the roost in 97. Simple Slinky had slunk into oblivion by 2000 as Texter Robot Dog, a motorised mutt that could bark, walk, eat and sleep, strutted through homes. Santa's Grotto was filled with gizmos in the noughties, Xbox 360 in 2005, Nintendo Wii a year later. I am the moaning ghost of Christmas past, chained to another age, perhaps 1973, when youngsters wanted nothing more than to see the Evel Knievel stunt cycle career into living room walls. And amid the noise, clatter, and blinding lights from a barrage of computer games this Christmas, the Grinch in my soul will yearn for an even darker time. It will cry out for 1950 and the Gilbert Atomic Energy Lab, a chemistry set that came with four samples of uranium ores and a Geiger counter. A gift near guaranteed to bring the house down and make the season glow. After gorging on Quality Street and indulging in the anaesthetic of wine and spirits, I dream of barking, "Alexa, detonate my nuclear device."
Hello, I'm Mina, and here's your Christmas cracker joke to get you in that festive mood.
Knock, knock. Who's there? Honda. Honda who?
Oh, God.
Honda, first day of Christmas, my true love sent to me.
Knock, knock. Who's there? Anna. Anna who? Anna Partridge in a pear tree.
How do Christmas trees get ready for a night out? They spruce up. Ooh,
What kind of music do elves like best? Rap music.
What do they sing at a snowman's birthday party? Freeze a jolly good fellow.
Who is never hungry at Christmas? The turkey. He's always stuffed.
Hi there, this is Amanda, and as we approach the festive season, thought it might be a nice idea to share some Christmas crackers with you, some jokes that will hopefully make you laugh, or indeed may make you groan. So sit back and enjoy, and indeed you may be able to guess what the answers will be. What goes oh, oh, oh? Santa walking backward. Knock, knock. Who's there? Ho, ho. Ho, ho, who? Your Santa impression needs a little work. No. What do you get if you cross Santa with a duck? A Christmas quacker. How do Christmas trees get their email? They log on. How do Christmas trees get ready for a night out? They spruce up. Knock, knock. Who's there? Noah. Noah who? Noah good Christmas joke? Knock, knock. Who's there? Santa. Santa who? Santa Christmas card to you. Did you get it? What is a vegan's favourite Christmas carol? Joy to the world.
With temperatures already falling across the region, time now to hear from our gardening experts at MK Pulse magazine, with handy tips and advice on how to prepare and protect our garden plants from the harsher weather to come.
Hello, this is Jan with some seasonal tips and ideas from the gardening expert at the MK Pulse magazine based in Milton Keynes. The parasitic plant we pucker up to. It might have fallen out of favour briefly when the pandemic restricted contact, including smooching, but that was just a blip in our long-lasting love affair with mistletoe. Historically, mistletoe has been considered a protection against evil and an aid to health and fertility. While we no longer subscribe to those notions, the green sprigs and its sticky white berries are still a common festive sight. Sprigs are held aloft in the hope of a cheeky peck, and the distinctive plant still features widely in Christmas decorations. Mistletoe is semi-parasitic, meaning it grows on host trees, the most common including apple and poplar. Its large globular shapes make it easily recognisable in the tops of trees. Mistletoe won't kill the tree it lives on, but it will absorb water and nutrients, which can leave the host weakened. If you intend working them into your own festive features or hang some above a doorway, it is important to remember that every part of the plant is poisonous to us and to our canine and feline friends, so do keep yours away from little folks, pooches and cats. Birds are partial to the berries, though, and when cleaning their beaks or through their waste, they unknowingly spread the seeds, allowing them to latch onto a new host and begin the slow process of germination. It's not as easy as sowing a bulb in autumn ready for blooms by spring either. It can sometimes take several years to mature, but don't let that stop you from having a go. You will need to choose a tree of some age. Around 15 years is great. It needs to be well established to take the aforementioned loss of nutrients. Don't use mistletoe, which has literally been hanging around during the festive period. It will have been harvested before maturity. Now isn't the right time to sow either. Ideally, berries should be harvested in March or April. Once you have your berries, choose a branch from the tree which is at least 10 centimetres thick and open to receiving lots of light. It should be high up. Ideally, you'll find a small crevice in the bark, but failing that, you can make a small slice in the bark, lift it, and insert the seeds. Plant several rather than one or two at each spot. They won't all germinate, and so more seeds means more chance of success. Once they are in place, replace the bark. Remember to keep the incision as small as possible to prevent the tree becoming infected. If you choose to wrap the branch in a little hessian, it will prevent the beaks of hungry birds enjoying a snack on your seed while it gets settled in. Then you'll need patience, because a berry or nine takes time. But when those spherical shapes appear in the treetops, you'll be thrilled, as will the local wildlife and birds, which will feast on it and help with the next germination. Or should that be generation? So, how does your garden grow? December's weather is often the worst of the year, but there is much to do in the garden. We have broad beans growing in pots in the cold frame and two rows in the raised bed. A few of the sweet pea seedlings need pricking out at 10 centimetres and kept in good light. And the children have sown two rows of pak choi and rocket for succession and have looked at Spring 24 catalogues to choose and order seeds for next year. In the orchard, we will prune the long shoots of the apple and pear trees back to the second or third buds to encourage fruit bud development. The cordons and espaliers will be pruned as well. Prune Clematis jackmannii and Vitticelli either down to 12 inches, that's 30 centimetres, or leave a framework of stem up to 36 inches, 90 centimetres. Also, prune wisteria tidily back to its trellis, to two or three buds from the main branch framework. Dogwoods and cornus should be pruned hard, down to 12 inches, 30 centimetres, to promote the growth of brightly coloured new shoots, which are so cheery in early spring. It is not too late to plant any remaining tulip bulbs in containers or in the ground. Any forced hyacinths should be brought into the light and put into a warmer place when the flower buds emerge. Temperatures in the greenhouse should be checked and the heater set to keep a minimum of 4 degrees centigrade if possible. The birds' water and feed areas should be topped up during the cold, short days.
Now, here come the quiz
answers.
Did you recognise the winter sport mentioned? Total count was 16. The sports named in this ski resort brain teaser were a mixture that might be found both at the Winter Olympics or as local activities. Here is the full list of answers read out in the order they were originally spoken. Nordic combined. Bobsled. Ice climbing, snowboarding, tobogganing, figure skating, dog sledding, downhill skiing, cross-country skiing, curling, snow kiting, luge, giant slalom, ski jumping, ice fishing, ice hockey. If you did catch all 16 of them, well done. And if you missed a few, hope you still enjoyed the challenge.
Now then, grab yourself a cuppa, perhaps a mince pie or a slice of Christmas cake too, and nestle down in your comfy spot.
Hello, I'm Colin. Does your heart sink when you receive a round robin in a Christmas card? Have you ever considered what these family updates really mean? Well, this may interest you. Cunningly concealed within greetings cards, out they come fluttering double-sided sheets of A4, charting all this year's neighbourhood news from the arrival of Keith's new shed to updates on how Jean is getting on with her titanium hip. This much maligned yet still widespread phenomenon took off during the 1980s, when home computers were introduced to the world. Suddenly, every amateur scribe could become a backroom publishing magnate, able to type up an annual family news roundup, printing multiple copies and tucking them inside their Christmas cards. As software and IT skills became more sophisticated, creative types even started incorporating photographs into the text. Up popped pictures of graduation ceremonies, fairy tale weddings, and purple-faced newborn babies. These festive bulletins are then sent out to everyone on the Christmas card list, ranging from cousins or close friends who have moved abroad to total strangers met briefly on holiday or at a conference. But as the content of the average round-robin letter is narrow in scope, they often read like a blend of faux-casual bragging about holidays, home improvements, and career success, seasoned with minutiae involving pets, neighbourly disputes, and physical ailments. Not forgetting a generous dollop of showing off about high-achieving children and darling grandchildren, in whom, if we're honest, nobody outside the family is terribly interested. Yes, the round robin will soon come bobbing along your garden path in the postman's bag. But don't despair, because as seasoned seasonal bulletin receivers will know, there's often more to these news blasts than meets the eye. Guessing the truth behind the upbeat tone and unsubtle boasting can take the fun of receiving a round robin to a whole new level. Here's a translation guide to things that people write in their round robin letters, and what they really mean. Dear friend. Dear person I met once, many moons ago, who will now receive these updates for the rest of eternity. Ben's having a great time at university and made lots of friends. We haven't heard from Ben since we dropped him off at his halls of residence in September. The garden is looking beautiful. The garden is looking better than John and Alison's next door. We were lucky enough to receive a windfall from a distant aunt. We were hoping she'd leave us more, to be honest. Caro has taken to motherhood effortlessly. Caro has turned into a zombie who self-medicates with Sauvignon Blanc on the stroke of 6 p.m. The grandchildren are doing well at school. The grandchildren are utterly average in their abilities. We had an idyllic holiday in the Seychelles, 2 weeks of blissful relaxation. I was so bored. We're already looking forward to next year's holiday. We wanted to show off about that too. Joshy the Labrador is getting old now, but he's still full of life. Joshy the Labrador sleeps most of the day and is beginning to smell. We're hoping to take a cruise. We've got nothing left to say to each other, so we want to start mingling with total strangers. Sophie's A-level results were a source of pride. We paid for Sophie to have extra tuition after she fell in with a bad crowd and began binge drinking in the park. Lotta won a medal at the school sports day. Lotta attends one of those schools where they don't believe in competitive sport, so everyone gets a medal. We had a glorious golden wedding anniversary celebration. You weren't invited. The new conservatory is a fabulous addition. It's ice cold in winter, sweltering in summer, takes all of the kitchen's light, but it cost a bomb, so we're pretending to like it. Sebastian has travelled extensively on his gap year, most recently in India. Sebastian is a work-shy embarrassman who's smoking something illegal on a beach in Goa. Our new next-door neighbours are quite the characters. We're in a bitter dispute over their loud parties and outdoor hot tub. Amelia managed 4 A's and 3 A stars in her GCSEs, though she was disappointed by the C in biology. Amelia's pushy parents were disappointed by the C in biology because they wanted her to be a surgeon. Enclosed are some photos of our safari trip in Kenya. Enclosed are some photos lifted off the internet because all of ours were blurry. I'm keeping busy with charity work. Mary is organising tea and cake sessions with her friends. Our much-loved cat, Mr. Snuggles, sadly passed away, but the grandchildren helped us hold a sweet funeral service in the garden. The vet's bill for cremation would have been extortionate. Hope you and yours are well. I can't remember your children's names. We must catch up next year. We'll never see each other again.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who without their support we would be unable to run this free service. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us, stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra! Thank you.